Welcome to Locked Into Vacancy. I'm your host, Eric. Today, we are still here. We're still locked in a vacancy. Isolation continues. It is now week three for me personally, working from home and just trying to make it through the day-to-day as they blur together, as the weeks become one. But we're doing the right thing. That's what I got to keep telling myself. And that's my big problem so far with this self-isolation slash quarantine slash breaking the curve, whatever it is we're doing it for the right reasons. It's stressful and everything else kind of sucks, but we're doing what we got to do. I'm flying by myself for the show today, so the discussion on the topic matter is going to be a little one-sided, so I hope you'll bear with me. What we've got on the show today is a look at Anton Chekhov's short story, The Bet. Now, for those of you who may not be familiar with Chekhov and his work, to sum him up briefly, he's considered to be one of the fathers of early modernism in theater, alongside Ibsen and Strindberg. And he doesn't have a whole lot of work to his name, owing partially to the fact that he died at, I think, the age of 44. He didn't live all that long, but even to this day, he's considered one of the best Russian playwrights, although he only produced four works, and he's considered one of the best short storytellers of all time. But again, that's open to conjecture. I'm a pretty big Chekhov fan. My background, of course, is in the theater. And unfortunately, my collegiate background didn't cover much of Chekhov and the modernist movement. I had a chair of the department who very much did not like Anton Chekhov and was very vocal about it. So unfortunately, my education there was lacking. But I digress. If you're interested in more of Chekhov's work and you want to check something out on your own, you may have heard of some of his works or seen them being produced. His four shows were The Seagull, Three Sisters, Cherry Orchard, and Uncle Vanya. And, of course, a huge collection, well, huge, quote-unquote, of short stories. They're all great. I think he was quite verbose, and he had a way with imagery that was very real and approachable. That may not make any sense, but, and I have no one here to say, oh yes, that makes sense, oh, that doesn't make sense, but it is what it is. Chekhov was great at what he did. It's unfortunate that he only graced us with 44 years on this planet, but we're lucky to have what we have. And that being said, we are going to dive into this story here, The Bet, which, if you're not familiar with it, is the story of a banker who makes a bet with a young man on the topic of imprisonment and whether it's whether being locked up for life is valid, is acceptable, if it's a good thing or a bad thing. And what they end up doing is they make a bet where the young man wages the banker's $2 million in exchange for the young man living completely in solitary for 15 years. And if he makes it the full 15 years and not a second earlier, then the banker will owe him $2 million. And if he chickens out or escapes or leaves before the end, then the banker's off the hook. And the story mostly follows the perspective of the banker and his internal monologue and how he struggles with knowing that there is this young man who is living inside a lodge on his grounds. And that was also part of the agreement, was that he had to live there so they could watch him, and they give him access to anything he wants. He can't see people and he can't leave. He can get books, he can get whatever, but I'm giving the whole thing away. So we're going to dive into it here. This is Anton Chekhov's The Bet here on Locked in a Vacancy, brought to you by Stories Telling Stories and STS Media Group. It was a dark autumn night. The old banker was walking up and down his study and remembering how, 15 years before, he had given a party one autumn evening. There had been many clever men there. There had been many interesting conversations. Among other things, they had talked of capital punishment. The majority of the guests, among whom were many journalists and intellectual men, disapproved of the death penalty. They considered that form of punishment out of date, immoral, and unsuitable for Christian states. In the opinion of some of them, the death penalty ought to be replaced everywhere by imprisonment for life. "I don't agree with you," said their host, the banker. "I have not tried either the death penalty or imprisonment for life. But if one may judge a priori, the death penalty is more moral and more humane than imprisonment for life. Capital punishment kills a man at once, but lifelong imprisonment kills him slowly. Which executioner is the more humane? He who kills you in a few minutes, or he who drags the life out of you in the course of many years?" "Both are equally immoral," observed one of the guests, "for they both have the same object, to take away life. The state is not God. It has not the right to take away what it cannot restore when it wants to." Among the guests was a young lawyer, a young man of 25. When he was asked his opinion, he said, "The death sentence and the life sentence are equally immoral. But if I had to choose between the death penalty and imprisonment for life, I would certainly choose the second. To live anyhow is not better than not at all." A lively discussion arose. The banker, who was younger and more nervous in those days, was suddenly carried away by excitement. He struck the table with his fist and shouted at the young man, "It's not true! I bet you $2 million you wouldn't stay in solitary confinement for 5 years." "If you mean that in earnest," said the young man, "I'll take that bet. But I would not stay 5, but 15 years.
15? Done!" cried the banker. "Gentlemen, I stake $2 million.
"Agreed. You stake your millions and I stake my freedom," said the young man, and this wild, senseless bet was carried out. The banker, spoilt and frivolous, with millions beyond his reckoning, was delighted at the bet. At supper, he made fun of the young man and said,
"Think better of it, young man. While there is still time, to me, $2 million is a trifle. But you are losing 3 or 4 of the best years of your life. I say 3 or 4 because you won't stay longer. Don't forget either, you unhappy man, that voluntary confinement is a great deal harder to bear than compulsory. The thought that you have the right to step out in liberty at any moment will poison your whole existence in prison. I am sorry for you."
And now the banker, walking to and fro, remembered all this and asked himself,
"What was the object of that bet? What is the good of that man's losing 15 years of his life? Am I throwing away $2 million? Can it prove that the death penalty is better or worse than imprisonment for life? No. No, it was all nonsensical and meaningless. On my part, it was the caprice of a pampered man, and on his part, simple greed for money."
Then he remembered what followed that evening. It was decided that the young man should spend the years of his captivity under the strictest supervision in one of the lodges in the banker's garden. It was agreed that for 15 years he should not be free to cross the threshold of the lodge, to see human beings, to hear the human voice, or to receive letters or newspapers. He was allowed to have a musical instrument and books, and was allowed to write letters, to drink wine, and to smoke. By the terms of the agreement, the only relations he could have with the outer world were by a little window made purposefully for that object. He might have anything he wanted, books, music, wine, and so on, in any quantity he desired by writing an order, but could only receive them through the window. The agreement provided for every detail and every trifle that would make his imprisonment strictly solitary, and bound the young man to stay there exactly 15 years, beginning from 12 o'clock of November 14th, 1870, and ending at 12 o'clock of November 14th, 1885. The slightest attempt on his part to break the conditions, if only 2 minutes before the end, released the banker from the obligation to pay him the $2 million. For the first year of his confinement, as far as one could judge from his brief notes, the prisoner suffered severely from loneliness and depression. The sounds of the piano could be heard continually day and night from his lodge. He refused wine and tobacco. Wine, he wrote, excites the desires, and desires are the worst foes of the prisoner. And besides, nothing could be more dreary than drinking good wine and seeing no one. And tobacco spoilt the air of his room. In the first year, the books he sent for were principally of a light character, novels with a complicated love plot, sensational and fantastic stories, and so on. In the second year, the piano was silent in the lodge, and the prisoner asked only for the classics. In the fifth year, music was audible again, and the prisoner asked for wine. Those who watched him through the window said that all that year he spent doing nothing but eating and drinking and lying on his bed, frequently yawning and angrily talking to himself. He did not read books. Sometimes at night, he would sit down to write. He would spend hours writing, and in the morning tear up all that he had written. More than once, he could be heard crying. In the second half of the sixth year, the prisoner began zealously studying languages, philosophy, and history. He threw himself eagerly into these studies, so much so that the banker had enough to do to get him the books he ordered. In the course of 4 years, some 600 volumes were procured at his request. It was during this period that the banker received the following letter from his prisoner. "My dear jailer, I write you these 6 lines in 6 languages. Show them to people who know the languages. Let them read them. If they find not one mistake, I implore you to fire a shot into the garden. That shot will show me that my efforts have not been thrown away. The geniuses of all ages and of all lands speak different languages, but the same flame burns in them all. Oh, if you only knew what unearthly happiness my soul feels now from being able to understand them." The prisoner's desire was fulfilled. The banker ordered 2 shots to be fired into the garden. Then, after the 10th year, the prisoner sat immovably at the table and read nothing but the gospel. It seemed strange to the banker that a man who in 4 years had mastered 600 learned volumes should waste nearly a year over one thin book easy of comprehension. Theology and histories of religion follow the Gospels. In the last 2 years of his confinement, the prisoner read an immense quantity of books quite indiscriminately. At one time, he was busy with the natural sciences. Then he would ask for Byron or Shakespeare. There were notes in which he demanded at the same time books on chemistry and a manual of medicine, and a novel, and some treatise on philosophy or theology. His reading suggested a man swimming in the sea among the wreckage of his ship, and trying to save his life by greedily clutching first at one spar and then at another. The old banker remembered this and thought,
"Tomorrow, at 12 o'clock, he will regain his freedom. By our agreement, I ought to pay him $2 million. If I do pay him, it's all over for me. I shall be utterly ruined."
15 years before, his millions had been beyond his reckoning. Now, he was afraid to ask himself which were greater, his debts or his assets. Desperate gambling on the stock exchange, wild speculation, and the excitability, which he could not get over even in advancing years, had by degrees led to the decline of his fortune, and the proud, fearless, self-confident millionaire had become a banker of middling rank, trembling at every rise and fall in his investments.
"Cursed bet," muttered the old man, clutching his head in despair. "Why didn't the man die? He's only 40 now. He will take my last penny from me. He will marry, will enjoy life, will gamble on the exchange, while I shall look at him with envy like a beggar, and hear from him every day the same sentence.
I am indebted to you for your happiness of my life.
Let me help you.
No, no. It is too much. The one means of being saved from bankruptcy and disgrace is the death of that man.
It struck 3 o'clock. The banker listened. Everyone was asleep in the house, and nothing could be heard outside but the rustling of the chilled trees. Trying to make no noise, he took from a fireproof safe the key of the door which had not been opened for 15 years, put on his overcoat, and went out of the house. It was dark and cold in the garden. Rain was falling. A damp, cutting wind was racing about the garden, howling and giving the trees no rest. The banker strained his eyes, but could see neither the earth, nor the white statues, nor the lodge, nor the trees. Going to the spot where the lodge stood, he twice called the watchman. No answer followed. Evidently, the watchman had sought shelter from the weather, and was now asleep somewhere either in the kitchen or in the greenhouse.
If I had the pluck to carry out my intention, thought the old man, suspicion would fall first upon the watchman.
He felt in the darkness for the steps and the door, and went into the entry of the lodge. There he groped his way into a little passage and lighted a match. There was not a soul in there. There was a bedstead with no bedding on it, and in the corner there was a dark cast iron stove. The seals on the door leading to the prisoners' rooms were intact. When the match went out, the old man, trembling with emotion, peeped through the little window. A candle was burning dimly in the prisoner's room. He was sitting at the table. Nothing could be seen but his back, the hair on his head, and his hands. Open books were lying on the table, on the 2 easy chairs, and on the carpet near the table. 5 minutes passed and the prisoner did not once stir. 15 years' imprisonment had taught him to sit still. The banker tapped at the window with his finger, and the prisoner made no movement whatsoever in response. Then, the banker cautiously broke the seals of the door and put the key into the keyhole. The rusty lock gave a grating sound and the door creaked. The banker expected to hear at once footsteps and a cry of astonishment. But 3 minutes passed, and it was as quiet as ever in the room. He made up his mind to go in. At the table, a man unlike ordinary people was sitting, motionless. He was a skeleton, with skin drawn tight over his bones, with long curls like a woman's, and a shaggy beard. His face was yellow with an earthy tint in it. His cheeks were hollow, his back long and narrow, and the hand on which his shaggy head was propped was so thin and delicate that it was dreadful to look at. His hair was already streaked with silver, and seeing his emaciated, aged-looking face, no one would have believed that he was only 40. He was asleep. In front of his bowed head, there lay on the table a sheet of paper on which there was something written in fine handwriting.
Poor creature, thought the banker. He is asleep, and most likely dreaming of the millions. And I have only to take this half-dead man, throw him on the bed, stifle him a little with the pillow, and the most conscientious experts would find no sign of a violent death. But let us first read what he has written here.
The banker took the page from the table and read as follows.
Tomorrow, at 12 o'clock, I regain my freedom and the right to associate with other men. But before I leave this room and see sunshine, I think it necessary to say a few words to you. With a clear conscience, I tell you, as before God who beholds me, that I despise freedom and life and health and all that in your books is called the good things of the world. For 15 years, I have been intently studying earthly life. It is true that I have not seen the earth nor men, but in your books I have drunk fragrant wine. I have sung songs. I have hunted stags and wild boars in the forest. I have loved women, beauties as ethereal as clouds, created by the magic of your poets and geniuses. Have visited me at night, and have whispered in my ears wonderful tales that have set my brain in a whirl.
In your books, I have climbed to the peaks of Elbers and Mount Blanc, and from there I have seen the sunrise, and have watched it at evening flood the sky, the ocean, and the mountaintops with gold and crimson. I have watched from there the lightning flashing over my head and cleaving the storm clouds. I have seen green forests, fields, rivers, lakes, towns. I have heard the singing of the sirens and the strains of the shepherd's pipes. I have touched the wings of comely devils who flew down to converse with me of God. In your books, I have flung myself into the bottomless pit, performed miracles, slain, burned towns, preached new religions, conquered whole kingdoms. Your books have given me wisdom. All that the unsettled thought of man has created in the ages is compressed into a small compass in my brain. I know that I am wiser than all of you, and I despise your books. I despise wisdom and the blessings of this world. It is all worthless, fleeting, illusory, and deceptive, like a mirage. You may be proud, wise, and fine, but death will wipe you off the face of the earth as though you were no more than mice burrowing under the floor, and your posterity, your history, your immortal geniuses will burn or freeze together on this earthly globe. You have lost your reason and taken the wrong path. You have taken lies for truth and hideousness for beauty. You would marvel if, owing to strange events of some sorts, frogs and lizards suddenly grew on apples and orange trees instead of fruit, or if roses began to smell like a sweating horse. So I marvel at you, who exchange heaven for earth. I don't want to understand you. To prove to you, in action, how I despise all that you live by, I renounce the 2 million of which I once dreamed as a paradise and which now I despise. To deprive myself of the right to the money, I shall go out of here 5 hours before the time fixed, and so break the compact.
When the banker had read this, he laid the page on the table, kissed the strange man on the head, and went out of the lodge weeping. At no other time, even when he had lost heavily on the stock exchange, had he felt so great a contempt for himself. When he got home, he lay on his bed, but his tears and emotions kept him for hours from sleeping. Next morning, the watchmen ran in with pale faces and told him they had seen the man who lived in the lodge climb out of the window into the garden, go to the gate, and disappear. The banker went at once with the servants to the lodge and made sure of the flight of his prisoner. To avoid arousing unnecessary talk, he took from the table the writing in which the millions were renounced, and when he got home, locked it up in the fireproof safe. The end. Locked Into Vacancy is produced in collaboration with Stories Telling Stories and STS Media Group, socially isolating itself at Milt House Studios in Milton, Vermont. Casting around the globe to your frontal lobe, wherever podcasts are found. Locked Into Vacancy is also streaming on YouTube at Stories Telling Stories. Make sure to give us a review wherever you stream our show. We really appreciate it. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram, and consider supporting us on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. And until next time, stay sane, stay safe, and stay whimsical.